Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. And with us now is New York Times columnist David Brooks. His writing these days is kind of on two tracks. He's got his takes on the news of the day, like his recent columns called Our Disgrace at the Border and Why You Love Mayor Pete. But he's also got the deeper dive into cultural and individual morality that he's also long been interested in, like today's column called Five Lies Our Culture Tells. And they're not Trump's lies about Russia or anything. They're lies like career success is fulfilling and life is an individual journey. And those are related to David Brooks' latest book, which is called The Second Mountain, The Quest for a Moral Life. David, always a pleasure. Welcome back to WNYC.
It's always great to be back with you.
And I'll bite on one of your five lies to start out. Life is an individual journey, and you nailed Dr. Seuss, of all people, on this one. Want to start there?
Yeah, he's got a book called Oh, the Places You'll Go, which we give to college graduates on their commencement day. But if you actually look at the book, it's a figure going through life in a solitary life on the way to success. There's no attachments. There's no friendship. There are no relationships. And I think that grows out of a culture that a lot of us, including me, have been sucked into, which is just an unconscious individualistic mindset.
And most of the other lies you name in that column are similarly related to individual fulfillment, including career success is fulfilling. You have to find your own truth, and I can make myself happy. And I get why you or anyone would critique a culture of narcissism and atomization, but why go so hard and centrally after thinking for ourselves outside of institutions?
Well, because I think our central crisis of our day is crisis of social isolation and disconnection. The level of people who say they're lonely is very high. 45,000 people kill themselves every year, and that's a proxy for loneliness. The suicide rate among teenagers is up 70% over the last several years, 72,000 dying of opiate addiction. We just don't treat each other very well, and I think individualism is a very good thing. But we've taken it to an extreme, and that's true in society. It's been true in my own life that I got sucked into the culture of the meritocracy, too, and found a moment in my life where I really was not good at friendship.
And was it related to, well, I was definitely struck by the line in your book, I'm sorry, in the column today, the first one of the cultural lies that we tell ourselves, that career success is fulfilling. And you write that when you found out that your first book was a bestseller, it felt like nothing to you. Did it really felt like nothing if you were putting out some meaningful ideas and people were responding to them?
Yeah, that part felt great. When people come up and say they were moved by your book, that part felt great. It was the ranking. It was the ranking part that really felt external to myself. And so I'm not against career success. I still work really hard at my job. But I think we are too accepting the culture of the meritocracy too much. And the meritocracy teaches us it's a culture of conditional love, that we can earn love through success. And it's a culture that says, even though it pretends not to, that people who've achieved a lot are sort of worth more than others. And that's just an awful message to be sending. And we take our young people, especially the privileged ones, and at age 16, we basically put them into this college admissions game where accomplishment and status hierarchy comes at the center of their lives. And that's just a bad way to begin adulthood.
And the college admissions cheating scandal has been in the news based on how it subverted the principle of admissions being a meritocracy. But you're down on the very idea of meritocracy, yeah, even without the cheating.
Yeah.
Explain why.
So, well, I believe in merit and achievement, but I think you have to have another mindset. And in the book, I call it the mindset of relationalism, that you're going to put relationship first, and that life is about doing relationships well. And that's easy to say, we all love relationships, but how you actually do it is the hard part. And so I walk people through things like, how do you choose a marriage partner? How in marriage do you actually give yourself away to the person you're married to? These are the hard things, to talk to people at their true depths.
You want to do one of those? How in marriage do you give yourself away to the person you're married to?
Well, first I tell my students, marriage is a 50-year conversation. Try to pick someone you can talk to yourself well. And then one of the tropes, I mean, some of them is practical advice I've read on a blog. Sometimes they say never go to bed mad. Sometimes just go to bed. Sometimes you're really tired. Another good tip is boast about your spouse and have them hear you boasting. But mostly it's a matter of dedication. Usually into any relationship, the person you thought was completely wonderful and perfect, you learn after a couple of years, they're actually kind of selfish. And as you're learning this about them, they're learning that about you. And so you have a choice. Do we have a truce marriage in which we sort of ignore the bad parts of each other? Or do we really give ourselves and say, you know, the problem in this marriage is not your selfishness, it's my selfishness. It's our own selfishness is the only one we can control.
And listeners, we can take some phone calls for David Brooks on the ideas we're talking about from his new book, The Second Mountain, The Quest for a Moral Life, or things in the news that he's been writing about or that you've heard him comment on NPR or elsewhere. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692 for David Brooks. And the title, The Second Mountain, you mean it almost literally, right?
Sort of, though also metaphorically. You know, a lot of us start our adulthoods and we think we're going to climb a certain mountain. I'm going to be a journalist, I'm going to be a teacher, I'm something. And then either you succeed and it doesn't seem that satisfying, or else you fail, or something happens that wasn't part of the original plan, a cancer scare, the loss of a child, and you're in the valley for a little while. And in those moments of suffering, you really learn a lot about yourself. And I think you get down deep into yourself and you find your ability to really care about other people. And at that moment, I think you realize, well, I actually have a bigger mountain ahead of me to climb. And I see at Second Mountain people, they're really oriented around others. Their ultimate orientation is not self. They've sort of got through that. And they serve a cause with a selfless devotion. I've got this project at Aspen Institute called Weave, the Social Fabric Project, and we spend time around community builders. And if you think they're so altruistic, they just live for deep relationship with others. How do I cultivate complete openness, complete vulnerability, complete honesty? And they're inspiring to be around. I think they have found a better way to live. We need to copy them, or at least I do.
You want to tell us a Second Mountain story?
Yeah, so for example, this was the toughest story on my travels in Ohio. I met a woman. Her valley was as deep as you can imagine. She came home one Sunday, and her husband had killed their two kids and himself. And she went through, as you can imagine, agony. But now she runs a free pharmacy. She helps women going through violence. And she said, I did it because I was angry at him. He tried to ruin my life. I wanted to show I could make a difference in the world and that I was going to lead a life of purpose and meaning. And she really is. But there's a phrase, a bright sadness, that a lot of these people have. They've seen the shadow of the world, but they still offer themselves in loving care.
And in your first few answers, you referenced yourself as having reached, you know, moments of self-realization and trying to take a different position. What's your story?
Yeah, I mean, on the outside, I've got this phenomenally lucky life where I've got to be a New York Times columnist. I mean, that's pretty great. I get to be on NPR and PBS. But inside, life is a lot more complicated. And so I had got to a point when I really was sucked in by the meritocracy. So I was valuing time over people. I wanted to be productive all the time. And I wasn't around for relationships. So in 2013 or so, my life sort of collapsed. And I was alone in an apartment. And I had not treated my friends well, and so I had a lot of weekday friends who I could go out and talk politics with. I didn't have a lot of weekend friends who were really the close, intimate friends who were just there for you. And those that I did have, I had sort of neglected those friendships. And part of neglecting myself, I hadn't really gotten in touch with the deeper parts of myself. And so I went through a tough time, and what I learned in that time was in those moments of suffering, you can either be broken or broken open. You either get hard and fearful, or you say, I'm going to be vulnerable and I'm going to be completely honest, and I've tried to be broken open.
Is this an especially American tension? Because don't the principles that our country is founded on politically, like the Bill of Rights, rest on the dignity of the individual and rebellion against the, you know, stifling European monarchies or religious monocultures that they came here to escape? And in the 20th century, rejecting communism and socialism out of an American notion of freedom, which would be the freedom of the individual to express oneself and also to get rich if you have the ingenuity to invent the better mousetrap.
Yeah, no, I love political freedom, but personal freedom sucks. Like, if you're unattached and you have nobody you're really caring for and caring for you, that's really a bad feeling. Individualism is our great gift because it leads us to have creativity. It's also our great weakness because we can take it too far. We have a friend from Kenya, and she lives in suburban Virginia right now, and she says there's no life here. And I think for people's sake, growing up in an African village, to come to an American suburb, the streets just seem empty and it seems lonely, and that's something we cope with, especially as Americans.
I'm curious if you see the root causes of where we are today as a culture in the failure or stagnation into irrelevance of traditional institutions, if we're at this point as a culture, it didn't come from nowhere.
Right. Yeah, I think it came from, we had a very collective culture in the 50s. We had to tackle the World War II, the Depression. And so if you grew up in Chicago, you said, you didn't say I'm from Chicago, you said I'm from 59th and Pulaski. The neighborhoods were really tight. But the problem with 50s culture, of course, it was super conformist. It was too tight. It was racist, anti-Semitic, tough on, I mean, it really constrained women. So we smashed it up in the 60s for a culture that said I'm free to be myself. And that had a left-wing variant, which was about lifestyle freedom. It had a right-wing variant about economic freedom. And that was good. But we had 60 years of hyper-individualism. We've sort of run out the string. And I'm afraid now we're going to go back to a culture of revert to tribe, because people are reverting to a tribal nature where they just scream at each other. And tribe is the dark twin of community.
Because people need community. And so if the old establishment institutions broke down because they were dysfunctional, but people are groping for how to replace it with other communities because people do crave community, you're afraid that it's going into dysfunctional ones.
Yeah, they do what their evolutionary roots tell them to, revert to tribe. And tribalism is the opposite of community. Community is based on our mutual affection for the same thing. Tribalism is based on our mutual hatred for some other, and it's always us, them, friend, enemy, erect walls, build barriers. And that really has what's destroyed our politics.
Let's take some phone calls. David Brooks is my guest. His new book is The Second Mountain, The Quest for a Moral Life. We also will talk some news and politics with him, which he continues to write about in his New York Times column. And Stephanie in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Stephanie.
Yeah, hi. Thanks a lot for taking my call. I'm a big fan of the show and of David Brooks. So that being said, I do want to share my initial impression or thought on what you're talking about. I get your premise that perhaps we're not leading as deep or as moral or connected life as we might, but what strikes me about this conversation is that it's lacking the financial and economic framework of the last few decades of rising inequality, whereby, hey, maybe people aren't hanging out with their weekend friends, by way of example, because, like, they're working, okay? And they're working long hours because they need to. And a lot of times the moral or emotional success that you're describing is not, they're not fulfilling it because they don't want to be poor. Like, you know, yeah, I'd love to be a teacher, but I think it's a luxury because I'm going to be dirt poor if I'm a teacher. And I work an 80-hour week because I feel like I need to. And that was my initial very strong impression to what you're saying. And I'm wondering if you could just sort of touch on that.
Yeah. So that's a very good point. And obviously our society is divided in a million different ways. By economic class, by racial divisions, and so on. The one thing I'd say is the people who are my models of the Second Mountain, these people who are weavers, they live often with very little money, but they really reach out in relationship to each other. And I found, in fact, that a lot of the people who are most spiritually alone are actually some of the richer people in society. And so if you go to I was in a community in Louisiana with really not a lot of money, and I was saying, you know, one of our problems is we don't know the neighbors who live right around us. And I got all these blank stares. And they looked back at me and they said, of course we know all our neighbors. And so they are deeply committed to place. I was just in Nebraska in a very rural town that's struggling economically, has lost a lot of jobs. And there was a woman there who, like in a lot of small towns, they wear multiple hats. She was a substitute teacher in the school. She was substituting for driving the bus, the school bus. She was helping form an arts council. And she's just someone who's deeply into her community. And it's not because she has so much privilege. She just that's what she's going to prioritize. And we all have souls, and everybody wants to lead a good moral life, a connected life. We all have hearts. And so it doesn't track as much along economic lines as I would have thought before I've taken this year-long journey. Huh.
Yeah, I was going to ask a version of the same question that Stephanie asked. I'm going to ask it anyway. because I think it furthers the conversation with what you just said. Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren would probably say the despair today comes less from the cultural decay that you're identifying as the source, but from the rich capturing politics, which allowed them to rig up a winner-take-all economy, and there is mass decline in the hope for being materially comfortable, hence the despair and the rejection of community institutions that didn't protect them.
I don't want to minimize the need for systemic change, and I write a lot about that all the time, but I do think you have to repair your society. You have to create connections and trust between people before you can do systemic change. And if you go back to the Great Depression, there was incredible economic hardship at that time. But weirdly, it was a moment where communities hung together to hang. They helped deal with the conflict, the hardship, through each other. And they did lean on each other. And so we have a lot of economic hardship, but for some reason we're not going toward each other to help us deal with it. We're withdrawing inward. And I think that's a cultural shift as much as a systemic one.
Randy in Riverdale, you're on WNYC. Hi, Randy.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Can.
Okay. My first part of my question is I've read Mr. Brooks for years and years and years, and at one point I noticed that his focus started veering off from the political into the sociological. And I wondered what made him make that change. The second part of my question is I think that Mr. Brooks went to Bronx Science, as did I. I grew up on the Lower East Side. I think he grew up in Stuyvesant Town. And I wondered if he would weigh in at all on the whole issue of diversity in the specialized high schools. And let me just say that I'm thrilled to be on the phone. And Brian, I think your show is amazing. And David Brooks, you know, you're one of my Republican heroes.
Randy, thank you very much.
Well, I did grow up in Stuyvesant Town, but I wouldn't have come within miles of getting into Bronx Science. So I did not. I went to Grace Church School in 10th and Broadway. And so I guess my view is that every institution needs to be diverse. And the travels around the country for this book have really radicalized me on some of the racial matters. That I've been to so many communities where the sense of racial injustice is sulfurically angry, and it's made me feel we're at, because of the election of Trump or whatever, we're at a make or break moment where we really have to show a gesture of dignity and respect for those who've been the victims of this injustice. And I wrote a column recently that I changed my mind on reparations for that reason. I do think we have to take some radical extra steps on that front.
Do you have a model for reparations? Do you go that far?
Yeah. Well, I'm like Cory Booker says, we got to first start the conversation. That will help. The model I've seen is super hard to do practically. You can do it through programs. But there's a baby bonds model where when a child was born, this happens in Europe in some countries, you put money in an account for the child to spend on education or job training when they get older. And that strikes me as a model that, frankly, helps us in a lot of ways.
And you did veer, as I think Randy put it, at a certain point, from somebody who is purely known as a political commentator to the kinds of things you've been writing about in addition for a long time. I mean, I know you have previous books called The Road to Character and The Social Animal, so you've been interested in these questions for a long time. I'm curious if you see your own thinking as having progressed or deepened in specific ways from the first of those books to today.
Yeah, I think they're all parts of a journey. And so even when I wrote The Road Character 4 years ago, I thought character building was individual thing we did within ourselves. You struggle against your own weakness. Now, I thought the basic culture of the country was healthy. Now I don't think that. I think the basic culture is very unhealthy, and it takes a more communal movement to solve the problems. And I think, you know, when we look at Trump and we look at our politics and all the tribalism around the world, frankly, I think it has deep spiritual and sociological problems. We just don't treat each other well. We don't do relationship. We see this rise of pain and agony, 72,000 people dying of opiate addiction, 45,000 people dying of suicide every year. This is a deep social problem, and it has to do with a loss of connection with each other. And so I think politics is downstream from culture, which is why I emphasize culture.
Is there a way to put it back together, make a country of second mountaineers, so that if people are searching for community in the, you know, contemporary context, that it doesn't just wind up with the worst forms of tribalism?
Yeah, I mean, culture shift. Like I mentioned, that shift from the culture of the 50s to the 60s, people figure out a way to do it. What do we need now? And we frankly don't need a culture of individualism right now. We need to shift a little back toward commitment making toward each other. And so what the second mountainous attempt to be is a not only a critique of our current culture, but a better way we can live. And I have plenty of examples of people who are living in a better way. And I have total faith in American ingenuity. We've been through this so many times. We've had really violent times in our politics. 1880s, we had big, massive immigration, economic transition, a lot of political corruption. By 1910, we'd sort of figured it out. And there was a cultural shift. The social gospel movement was communal. There was a civic renaissance, creation of the Boys and Girl Scouts, the Boys and Girls Clubs, the Settlement House movement. And then there was the progressive movement. And so we figured it out. And I have every confidence we'll do that again.
Where do you see the new democratic socialists fitting into this? Because when you look at AOC and the others in her camp of freshmen, you could say these are people who are really committed to a communal sense of trying to accomplish something that they believe in for the particular communities that they come from and for the country that's very different from, you know, some stereotypical old model of, gee, I made it to Congress.
Right. Yeah, and I disagree with a lot of them on policy, but I totally see it as an attempt, a legitimate attempt to try to address the ravines in our society and an attempt to say, well, what about the common good? And that's a conversation that we sort of drifted away from. And they're saying we're all linked, we're all brothers and sisters together in this country. And it can't be that some people are living radically different lives than other people. And so I totally sympathize with what's done. I see it as part of our cultural adaptation. Socialism is really communal. And I might disagree with how you use the government or what's a wise policy, but it seems to me it's part of the movement that's leading to the right response.
Nick in Astoria, you're on WNYC with David Brooks. Hi, Nick.
Hi, good morning. And Mr. Lehrer, you have a great show. And Mr. Brooks, one of the highlights of my week is Friday night's PBS NewsHour.
Oh, well, thank you.
I love your analysis.
We have fun.
Piggybacking on what was just mentioned about the socialist movement, I have to say I'm a big supporter of the Green New Deal. What I hear from it, I really like, and I see it as another form of team building, working together and moving away from individual gain. So I've heard you mention some reservations on the Green New Deal. I'm just wondering if you could – I heard you mention that you think it puts a little bit too much power in the hands of government. But again, because I see it more as a teamwork kind of approach, I'm curious, why the reservation on Green New Deal?
Yeah, it's for exactly that reason. And, we have a Washington establishment, which I think is very dysfunctional. And the idea that we're going to put energy policy more and more in their hands, the idea that we're going to put healthcare system more and more in their hands, it just raises some of the things I saw when I covered European politics in the 80s and 90s, which was you can lead to a lot of stagnation when you concentrate everything in Washington's hands. One of the things I think Europe teaches us these days is the countries with the biggest welfare states also have the freest markets. And they tried to put everything in the central government's hands, and it led to economic stagnation because government just can't move fast enough for the economy. So they wanted to keep their welfare states. So they said, well, how can we create an economy so we can afford to have this welfare state? So they took away a lot of the limits on how companies can work. And they opened up trade, and they opened up a lot of stuff. And now I think they're at a pretty good place where they have very competitive, very dynamic economies, but also reasonably generous welfare states.
What's a country like that?
Well, Denmark is Sweden is an example. And sometimes we say, oh, those are socialist countries. Well, ask a Swede if they live in a socialist country. They say, we do not live in a socialist country. We have a capitalist economy with a collective sense of we're going to take care of everybody in our society.
Huh. We have just a few minutes left. Let's talk a little bit about the news. Your column on April 1st, why you love Mayor Pete, that may have even evolved since then, but what's your take?
Yeah, I mean, I'm drawn to the people who are not only policy differences from what we have, but moral differences. And he just seems like a decent, good guy, very smart guy, obviously. But also, I think he and Cory Booker, Beto O'Rourke, they preach, like, let's move away from this. Let's not be fighters. Let's try to be one people. Let's try to appeal to our better angels. And I'm just exhausted by the last 2 years. I can't imagine going through this for six more, frankly. And so I really am drawn to the candidates who say, no, we can win on decency.
You think Elizabeth Warren, to take another example, isn't trying to win on decency?
No, I think she's very substantive, very decency. I would say the people, and this is not a judgment, this is a just a sense of how they're presenting themselves. I do think Bernie Sanders and Kamala Harris are they're presenting, we need to fight this. This is a war. We need to fight this. And maybe they're right. Maybe that's the right way to approach it. But personally, I'm a softie. I'm drawn to the Pete Buttigieg's.
And your column last week called Our Disgrace at the Border. What's the disgrace as you see it?
Yeah, the fact that we don't have a system, a government that can solve problems. You got a bunch of people at the border. Any mayor would do the obvious thing. We're going to build more places for these people to stay. We're just sending more judges to reduce the backlog. We may have a program to vet the refugee claims in their home countries so little kids don't have to walk 1,500 miles. These are basic practical things. But we don't have a practical conversation because everything turns into an ideological assault, or Donald Trump just wants to pose as a manly man. And so I just want like somebody to just be a boring person to do systems and make it work.
Michael Bloomberg.
Bloomberg. I'm like this guy, Larry Hogan, governor of Maryland.
Republican who might challenge Trump in the primaries.
Right. And he's like not the most charismatic guy on the face of the earth, but he's very popular in a Democratic state because he gets stuff done. The mayor of Detroit is like this too. I've had it with charisma. I just want a boring person.
Last thing. What are you going to be looking for from the Mueller report on Thursday morning?
Mostly the culture of the Trump administration. Like they've had such access to what it actually is like there. And what is the climate? Are there any morals there? Is there any sense? I guess we don't expect a legal thing. So I'm looking at, is there anything decent going on inside there?
Yeah. And I guess one of the things in the news today, I think reported by NBC, was that some members of the administration who might even be high-ranking officials or former officials are wondering if they're going to be named in having said really bad things about Trump.
Yeah. Well, I know they think it.
David Brooks, New York Times columnist. His new book is The Second Mountain, The Quest for a Moral Life. And if you want to see David Brooks in person, he's got a talk and book signing tonight at 6:30 at the Cafe Auditorium, 1745 Broadway in Manhattan, second floor. That's Broadway between 55th and 56th Streets at one of his publishers, Big Ideas at Random House events. Again, 6:30 tonight, 1745 Broadway between 55th and 56th. Thank you for stopping here on the way.
Great to see you again.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC with much more to come.